Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Salt Lake Tribune analysis shows that Utah police disproportionately shoot at racial and ethnic minorities. Childhood polio survivors say that what we don't know about the long-term effects of COVID should concern us. And water is very cheap in many Utah cities and towns. The result? Residents here use more water than any Western state. We'll hear about some proposed solutions to a conservation problem. Joining me for this conversation via Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Good morning, Peyton. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And we've also got Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke. And welcome to you, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. And a little bit later in the show, we'll hear from the Tribune's Luke Peterson and Zach Podmore. Stick around for that. Listeners, we invite you to join with your comments and questions on Twitter. Just tweet to them to our handle, at KCPW. Peyton Harkins, let's see, you and your colleagues this week wrote a story that was basically impossible to write until you had all of the data in hand. The Tribune and PBS Frontline have been compiling a bunch of statistics on police shootings in Utah. And some of what you've gleaned from that data we've talked about before on this show, that includes a deep dive into who on various police forces is doing the shooting or the bulk of the shooting. This week, though, you published a story describing what these records show about who is getting shot at in Utah, looking in particular at the race of those being fired upon. And as I teased in the introduction just a minute ago, there's a disparity in, in the data. Can you tell us what it shows, Peyton?
Yes. So basically what our reporting found was over the last decade, so between 2010 and 2020, racial and ethnic minorities ended up accounting for about a third of all police shootings in Utah, whereas those groups make up just a quarter of the population here.
And so a third of the shootings, so as an absolute number, the numbers show that people who are white are shot at more than any other group in Utah, but it's when you account for the population percentages that the picture becomes quite a bit clearer here, and it shows that there's a disparity.
Yeah, because, I mean, we all living in Utah, we all know Utah is a very white state. And so the most recent census numbers came out and it had about 75% of Utahns are white, yet they account for about 64% of all police shootings. So there's that disparity there. And it's made up for by the, you know, sort of disproportionate number of racial and ethnic minorities that are shot at.
And the disparity is in the data that you dug into. And I kind of want to get into how you gathered that data, but that disparity is most pronounced for Black people. Is that correct to say?
Yes, it is. Like, we included in our story, there's a bar graph where you can kind of see it laid out in front of you, where it shows, you know, it with a red bar, the percent of people shot at, and with a tan bar, you know, Utah's population. And you look at it, and with Black people, the difference between those two bars is pretty striking. It's 1.1% of Utah's population is Black compared to 7% of people shot at who are Black, but shot at by police, I should say.
In this analysis, you also looked at who was holding a weapon and what kind of a weapon they were holding when they were shot at. Those are maybe instances, you know, when someone's holding a weapon where there is often a more clearly justifiable use of force by police, though that's not a hard and fast rule. I guess, Peyton, yeah, what did the records you gathered show about people who were holding weapons and the shootings that occurred, you know, and police shootings in terms of the race, this analysis on race that you did?
Yeah. So what we were able to find is that more basically white people, when they were shot at when white people were shot at by police, they more often had guns. Like, I think in 62% of cases they had guns, whereas racial and ethnic minorities, they were, you know, more often than not did not have guns. It was about 40%, 43, I think, percent of the time they had guns. But then when you start looking at who was having, you know, who was holding an edged weapon, it's actually half the people shot while carrying an edged weapon were racial and ethnic minorities, where as white people, it was a much smaller number.
And I guess just to clarify, edged weapon would be, I mean, sort of shorthand for a knife and or other type of weapon like
Yeah,
that.
we have knives and, swords, anything with sort of an edged blade.
Okay. So white people were more likely to have a gun when they got shot at, but they still got shot as a group, or shot at, I guess, as a group when you account for the population percentages less than racial and ethnic minorities, even though they had guns.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And then there's data on people who were unarmed, and there's one group that more frequently was on the receiving end of police shootings when you look at the data of those shot at when unarmed. Can you tell us about that, Peyton?
Yes, and this was actually something when we shared the data with Ian Adams with the Fraternal Order of Police, which is, the union that represents police officers in Utah. He was actually the one that noticed this, and it was that Hispanic men are overrepresented among people who are shot while unarmed. And unarmed people don't make up a ton of cases in this database. I think there were 19 over the past decade, but six of those people, so about 30%, were Hispanic men.
Wow. I'm curious, I want to get to the you spoke to some people about the kind of whys for why some of this might exist, but I kind of want to get to how you did the gathering of data that you did. I mean, this is you and your colleagues, this is Frontline PBS. What did this entail?
Yeah, so this, we got the grant for this project almost a year ago at this point. And this was something that we knew we wanted to do, and we knew it was going to be difficult because, law enforcement records on race are kind of scant. Stuff like that. So it's like it was difficult for us to figure it out. And so we started a year ago with we had a person at Frontline and then some fellows at Frontline, and they literally, went through our database and called the families of some of these people who were shot. Sometimes we reached out to the person themselves if they survived to try to figure out their race. That took, hours. And then once we kind of exhausted those resources, that's when we had to start relying on those sort of police documents. And some, like Unified Police Department, for instance, it's just kind of their standard that when you get a document from them, they're going to redact the person's race. And so it's like you either, appeal those records and try to get it, or what we ended up having to do in a lot of cases, about 120, I think, was just find some kind of photo of them. Some of these people had been in jail previously, so there's mugshots that we could look at, or if they died, some of them had obituaries. Pictures or their Facebooks or something. And basically it was just like, you kind of had to look at a person and make a judgment call. And we just kind of did that with the goal of trying to get the race or ethnicity of as many people as possible, because it's like, I don't know, the more unclears you have in the database, the more unclear this data is. And it was really important for us to have, as many of these that have the race of as many people as possible, so we could have some pretty clear conclusions.
Just turning back to the, thank you for describing that, by the way, to the why there is this disparity. You and your colleagues sought answers from some experts and researchers on why this disparity exists, and you spoke to, among other people, a criminology professor at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. What's sort of the, I mean, I think we could probably intuit or throw out our own ideas for why this exists, but what do the experts say, I guess?
Yeah, so that professor that you're talking about, his name is Justin Nix, and he said, the clearest explanation for why racial and ethnic minorities are shot at disproportionately is that they get stopped by police disproportionately. And there's, sort of decades of research that, in social science research that where, researchers have been looking into these issues, and it's found that officers generally treat people worse. And by that, I mean there are more, unjustified traffic stops, or they might be verbally abusive in their interactions with them, or they might stereotype these people when they're in neighborhoods that are poorer and are predominantly populated by racial and ethnic minorities. But it doesn't all fall on the police. Like often policing is reactionary. They get a 911 call from somebody and they go and respond. And so he was also saying that people are more likely to report, for instance, a Black person to police for being suspicious when they're doing something that they wouldn't call the police about if it were a white person.
And that leads to a chain of events that then results in, for example, a shooting.
Yeah.
I also want to talk about, I know this is something that Professor Nix does, that what can be done about this? Your reporting digs into into the idea of, I mean, Professor Nix, for example, from Nebraska, says that, you know, one of those, he's one of those people who doesn't think that something like implicit bias training is going to be all that useful in, you know, quote unquote, solving this problem. Can you talk about why not, or what he says about that?
Yeah. And, you know, all of the researchers we talked to, they thought training was good. You know, obviously you don't want untrained officers going out, and people need to be aware of their biases. And so training needs to exist to kind of show people that if they're unaware, and kind of, you know, so they can act in ways that, you know, makes that bias less. But at a certain point, it's like implicit bias is just kind of so ingrained in all of us just by virtue of, you know, growing up in the United States and sort of the, you know, the issues that exist here. And so sort of there's kind of a, you know, a growing number of people who think that we should just create policies and practices that don't put officers in situations where they, you know, might end up shooting somebody, especially somebody, you know, like, for instance, I just said that racial and ethnic minorities get pulled over more than, you know, white people, basically. And it's like, if you can get officers out of those situations where they're pulling people over without cause, you know, maybe there will be less shootings because that, you know, because of that. Hmm. So that was one of the solutions we got, you know, just don't pull people over that often. There was actually in Fayetteville, North Carolina, they did this, and it did reduce, you know, deadly use of force and also injuries to both civilians and officers and complaints against officers. So there, you know, there seems to be some, you know, merit to that.
Hmm. There's a couple of quotes from your article that I thought were very interesting. Nix said that studies that put police officers in simulations and then analyzed how they react, it shows people are more likely to misjudge an object for a weapon if a black person is carrying it. And he said that police are quicker to shoot someone in those situations. And then you spoke to Dolores Jones Brown, who's a professor emerita at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. And she said that police are instinctively conditioned to see black people in particular and people of color in general as more threatening. And so, right. And then there's the kind of ingrained implicit bias that maybe can't be trained away because it's been part of your sort of societal upbringing for, you know, for so many decades that a couple mm-hmm. of classes isn't going to fix that. Peyton, I want to bring in Robert Gerke, the news columnist here, and then keep coming back to you with some other questions. But let's ask Robert. Peyton's reporting here, Gerke, points to, it points to data that I think a lot of what the sort of conclusions here are not surprising to a lot of people. Were you at all surprised by it, Robert?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I think it's pretty consistent with both what we sort of witnessed with our own eyes, but also what studies have shown nationally. I think it's important, though, because you know, if you need to have a baseline, and if you want to talk about, is there a problem, you need to have the data back it up. And then once you've produced the data to, you know, demonstrate that an issue exists, I think you can start having discussions about, you know, how to resolve it. And so I think it's very important. I think going forward, you know, now we have something that we can measure forward from. We can see if some of the measures that have been put into place, over the last few years, like bias training, end up paying off in the long run. So,
what do you think about that? I mean, some of the researchers are saying that there's not much value in things like implicit bias training. What are your thoughts there, Robert?
Yeah, I think that the data does show that the effects are marginal and not long lasting. That's sort of the consensus, I think, on the bias training piece of it. But you know, there have been other measures that the legislature's taken over the last couple of years to try to more closely at least monitor deadly use of force or use of deadly force. And you know, I think that, you know, now that there is data, and it's kind of surprising, frankly, that you know, and kudos to Peyton and Jessica for all the effort that went into gathering this data, but it was kind of surprising that it didn't exist in some way, shape, form that was easily accessible before. They had to, you know, it took a lot of effort to put this together. But it's important, like I said, because now we have a definition, now we have a baseline, and now we can actually have discussions about what we need to do about it and measure if those things that we do actually work in the end. So I think that's an important piece of this.
Peyton, I'm going to come back to you. I guess a question that I have there is, and I don't know if you can answer this, but why wasn't and why isn't this information being compiled other than by, you know, the Tribune, by gathering all of this through records requests from various police agencies? Is that a question you can answer?
Sort of, but it's not a great answer. You know, there just hasn't really been the will to do it. I was actually reading a paper from the early 80s the other day on policing, and the author was lamenting even back then, you know, like in the United States, we have a really good idea of the number of homicides every year. And that's, you know, partly because of good reporting, partly because it's, you know, you can't get rid of a body that easily, you know, so it's like as for other crimes like robberies, for instance, you might undercount them, but homicides, we have a good handle on. But when it's officer caused homicides, nobody kept track of them. And he was, you know, he was upset about this in the early 80s. And, you know, you look online, you know, the FBI doesn't keep track of this. They said they're going to start, but they hadn't previously. You know, the Washington Post in 2015 started their database of police shootings, but that's just fatal shootings. You know, there's not very many places across the country where you can get any idea of the you know, amount of deadly force police are using, and it's kind of been left up to news organizations. And in Utah, that's us, or you know, we're among the people who do the news here, but you know, we're the one keeping this database.
Right, and I know that it's something that you plan on keeping, you're continuing to do. You'll keep tracking this data into the foreseeable future. Just on the, I don't know, something you said, is there a way to break out, I don't know who you just quoted, but you described someone saying, you know, officer caused homicide. And I'm wondering if there's a distinction between those incidents. I mean, it's very rare for an officer's shooting to be ruled, for example, unjustified by a prosecutor. And I don't know, this is just part of the data that you're tracking, I guess, Peyton. And I don't know if you want to comment there, but I also know that you quoted the current head and the past head of Black Lives Matter Utah for this story. And they, like other people, said that they were definitely not surprised by this reporting. What did they say? And what did they say they hoped would happen as a result of what your reporting shows, Peyton?
Yeah, Ray, the new leader of Black Lives Matter, Ray Duckworth, and the previous leader, Lex Scott, they were similar to a lot of lawmakers and police, well, maybe not police, police no, didn't tell us they were surprised about this, but a lot of lawmakers told us they weren't surprised. And obviously, you know, Ray Duckworth and Lex Scott weren't surprised. They've been out on the streets protesting against this for years. They would really just like something to be done. In their opinion, the, you know, the bills that have been passed previously are the sort of modest reform efforts that have gotten through the Utah legislature. That's not enough. And people, you know, continue to be shot and continue to be killed by police. And they would just like something to happen. They're both very into this idea. It's called community control. Basically, it's where the civilians have some kind of sort of hiring and firing and oversight ability over police departments. They think that would go a long way in holding officers more accountable for these shootings. But yeah, when I was talking to Ray Duckworth in particular, she's told me that seeing this data, it makes her realize that she's not just, you know, quote, living in Utah. She said she's surviving here. You know, that's how this data made her feel, that it's more, you know, yeah.
We have to head to a break here and come back with our final segment of the show before we turn to some recorded features. But Peyton, again, this is a database that you will continue to update. You'll continue to keep tracking this data into the foreseeable future. But is it going to get any easier to compile this information, having done it, I guess, the one time?
That's the hope. There was a bill passed, I think, in this last session that is going to start requiring officers to report this information to the state. And also there is a bill that's passed that we're actually going to know anytime an officer points their gun now too, which that's going to add a lot of, you know, clarity to this data, because right now we have an issue where we know when police shoot, but we don't know how often they have the option to shoot, I guess, you know, they point their gun and don't end up doing it. So that will, you know, that'll paint a completely different picture. Maybe we'll see.
We will see. That's Peyton Harkinson. Peyton, thank you for, well, for your reporting on this and for explaining it to us. She's a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a quick break, a two-minute break, and when we come back, the three of us will offer up our underplayed stories of the week, and then we will turn to a breakdown of why water is so cheap in Utah when compared with other Western states, and to the parallels some childhood polio survivors see between our current epidemic and the one that they lived through. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Peyton Harkins and Robert Gerke. This is your Friday morning news roundup. To save time for a couple of recorded segments, we will turn right now to our picks for underplayed story of the week. And this is where we draw your attention to a story you may have missed or that we otherwise, you know, liked. Robert Gerke, do you want to kick us off here with an underplayed story?
Yeah, I want to point to some reporting that Aaron Alberti did, some pretty, again, sort of like the work Peyton did, that's very data intensive. Looking at the COVID vaccinate or COVID infection rates at the Salt Lake County school districts and whether specifically whether Salt Lake City's mask mandate is working. And it kind of dovetails with the piece that Courtney Tanner did that reporting on how districts are not necessarily abiding by the recommendations from the state on when students quarantine. And so it's kind of a two-headed problem. The cases are being reported in a timely manner, and then districts aren't making kids quarantine as the state recommends. So two important pieces that we kind of need to get taken care of if we're going to, you know, get on top of this COVID in schools issue.
Yeah. Thank you for those picks. Great picks, Robert. Peyton Harkins, we will turn to you now for your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah. So mine comes from the Tribune's Innovation Lab. Sage Miller wrote this nice story about a woman's journey to help members of the Navajo Nation sort of connect with health info and resources. And it talks about how it became something much bigger and helped people with care packages during the pandemic and also just kind of learning about their culture and having pride in it. And this website that she created, it also became a space where community members could learn about and kind of talk about complicated topics that might not get talked about much in the Navajo Nation, like mental health and sort of LGBTQ issues. So I recommend that.
Awesome. Thank you, Peyton, for that pick. For my part, this isn't a story, but Pat Bagley published a cartoon of the cows from Chick-fil-A, from the ad campaign that Chick-fil-A does. And, you know, they have the life-size cow statues that are painting billboards to say, eat more chicken, misspelled, I guess, the way that cows would do. That's always creeped me out, actually. But anyway, Bagley's cartoon had them painting a billboard with the words, take more people medicine. And the sad pun is that people are taking this anti-parasitic for horses and for cows, ivermectin. The Utah Department of Health this week urged people not to take it after a patient here in Utah or after someone here in Utah was sent to the hospital for taking it, trying to treat their COVID-19, apparently. But it didn't work. In fact, it made him really sick. So that's my pick, a funny Bagley cartoon and a, you know, demonstrating the not-so-funny reality that we are living in. Robert Gerke and Peyton Harkins, both with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you for those picks and also for your coverage and for joining us on the show this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah. Find their reporting over at sltrib.com. Now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Zach Podmore, who this week wrote a detailed explainer on how water gets paid for in Utah and on the measures conservationists and some conservative tax reformers want to see Utah take to change how that's done in the state. Take a listen. Zach Podmore, Southern Utah reporter and Report for America Corps member at the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me, as always. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Roger.
Of course. You wrote this week a detailed explainer on water in Utah, water use in Utah. And, you know, I think a few people know this part already, which is that Utah residents use more water than residents in other Western states, than in any other Western state, in fact. Zach, to what extent is that the case? I know it's not uniform across the state of Utah water use, but how much water do we use as compared to other Western states?
Yeah, so the, I mean, it varies from city to city in Utah what the per capita usage is. But in a place like Washington County, where St. George is located, the average resident uses 306 gallons of water per day. Now you can compare that to a place like Phoenix, which is, you know, a little bit warmer than St. George, but not much, where residents use 111 gallons per day, according to the latest numbers from the USGS. So in the story, Zach Frankel of the Utah Rivers Council talks about, you know, making the 90-minute drive from St. George to Las Vegas, where they're basically the same kind of climate between these two cities, but water use in Las Vegas is almost a third of what the water use is in Washington County. So there's a big disparities from places that aren't that far apart or that different climate-wise.
Yeah, and one of the identified reasons for this high water use in Utah as compared to those other places is the way that water rates work in the state. The basics here are that water is cheap in Utah. Can you give us a kind of the primer on that part of the story, the fact that rates are low here? Why are they lower? How much lower?
That's right, yeah. So not only does Utah use more water than neighboring states, for its residents, but it also pays some of the lowest utility bills for water. And those two things, many people think are connected. For the amount of water that people use in their homes, which is somewhere around on average, 7,000 gallons per month, water rates are comparable in Utah cities to other Western cities. But when you start using more water and using that water to irrigate landscaping, rates in other places shoot up really dramatically. So in Phoenix, for example, residents pay, a monthly connection fee and then get their first 7,000 gallons or so of water. It's included with that connection fee. There's no additional charge. But as soon as they start using more than that average indoor use for a month, the rates skyrocket from, just a few dollars per 1,000 gallons of water to $20 per 1,000 gallons of water. Whereas in Moab, for example, the rates climb up very slowly. They stay under $2, even if you use, 60, 70, 80,000 gallons of water in a month in a single household. So that's kind of a complicated way of saying that there are aggressively tiered rate structures in other cities that, discourage people from using a lot of water on landscaping.
And yeah, so it's, and that tiered pricing means less water use. People are more conscious of the water that they're using. And so it's cheap on the rates side here in the state of Utah, but there's also a sort of hidden cost. Some have called it a subsidy in the form of property taxes. And I'm wondering if you can explain how those taxes in Utah, in various municipalities are tied to water. How that works, Zach, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Utah doesn't have some kind of magical formula for being able to provide their water much more cheaply than surrounding states. They just have a different way of paying for it by and large. I mean, there's differences between municipalities and water districts across Utah, but I think it's safe to say that generally the vast majority of people in Utah pay lower bills than surrounding states, but pay higher property taxes when it comes to the amount of money that's going to fund water projects. This is, again, Zach Frankel, who's in the story of the Utah Rivers Council, he refers to this as kind of hiding the true cost of water. When you get your bill at the end of the month and you've used 40,000 gallons of water to, maintain a really green lawn in a really dry area through the summer, and it's relatively low, you might think that that's something you could continue to do, which you might not wake up to the fact that water's been paid through already through property taxes, I guess.
And that's interesting. And that the fact that that's happening, I mean, you write in your article, Zach, water wholesalers that are funded through property taxes often store, transport, and treat water before selling it to municipalities at a reduced rate, which enables local water departments to charge less on utility bills. That the fact that there's that subsidy, the fact that it's paid for in property taxes, is kind of unique to Utah, correct? I mean, that's not something we're seeing in a lot of other municipalities outside of Utah.
That's correct. Yeah, again, there's so many different ways that this is structured from state to state, from county to county, from city to city, that it's a little hard to do an apples-to-apples comparison across the whole region. But there have been a number of surveys done, and Utah is unique in relying on property taxes more than other areas. Other water districts, some other water districts do levy property taxes. Some, you know, just pay for their services through utility bills and impact fees and that sort of thing. But Utah, yeah, seems to be one of the only states in the West that relies on property taxes to the extent that it does. Some water districts, you know, receive more than half of their yearly budget or up to three quarters of their yearly budget from property taxes as opposed to utility bills.
Here in Utah.
Here in Utah.
Yeah. You spoke to a researcher who has ties to both the University of Utah and also to Colorado State University, I believe, who described the property tax setup as inherently unfair. Can you tell us why that's sort of another component of this story?
Yeah, that's correct. Robin Rothfetter, who's a professor at Colorado State University and who did his dissertation work at the University of Utah looking at this issue really closely in the Salt Lake Valley in particular, found that homeowners in wealthier neighborhoods used up to five times more water than those in poorer neighborhoods, but they ended up, you know, paying less property taxes at, you know, as a percentage of their income than the folks that were using less water. So he says, you know, changing Utah's system to do what other states have done, from, you know, Phoenix to Las Vegas to even wetter places like Seattle, Washington, and have these aggressively tiered rate structures for water that, you know, get more expensive the more water you use per month, would do the most to benefit lower income families. So
right, because it would change the structure and it would get rid of that inequality, I guess, there that you described, or that he described. And it's also something that has the backing of, I mean, changing the structure or reforming the rate structure for water in Utah has the backing of conservationists, but also of some other groups as well. Can you talk about the push for reform to the way that water is paid for in Utah?
That's right. So this has been around for a long time. This is an issue people have, you know, been talking about since the 1990s or earlier. There have been a series of bills that have been considered in the legislature over the years, though none of them have gotten very far. The most recent was in 2017, and it would, you know, propose certain reforms to the amount of property tax that water districts are able to collect. And it was supported by conservative groups like the Utah Taxpayers Association and the Libertas Institute, a libertarian think tank who, you know, want to see lower taxes in general and don't think that water should be paid for through property taxes as opposed to water bills. And, you know, the Utah Taxpayers Association returned to this issue this summer in the middle of the drought and said, you know, that this would be if Utah were to make these reforms and, you know, if Utah residents were able to pay through water through their utility bills as opposed to property taxes, it would do a lot to, you know, incentivize people to conserve water in dry times, which is exactly what environmental groups are saying as well. You know, these are groups from either end of the political spectrum, maybe.
Yeah, at least different parts or different sectors of our political universe. I guess, you know, what do the water purveyors in Utah, what does the water lobby say about the push to break water away from property taxes and to implement a tiered structure of water rates or whatever that fix may be?
Yeah, that's a great question. The water districts and water lobbyists have been very opposed to all of these reforms from what I hear. They feel that the property tax structure that Utah uses allows them to be a lot more flexible in how they spend money, how they build infrastructure, how they pay for projects than trying to rely on those utility bills that are coming in month by month. There are you know, a large number of water lobbyists working in the legislature more than in any other industry. And the last numbers I saw were a few years old, but there were, you know, four times more lobbyists in the legislature than lawmakers themselves. So this is something
Four times more water lobbyists or four times more lobbyists in general?
Lobbyists in general, but the greatest number of They're more lobbyists than for any other industry. So this is a, you know, pretty powerful group, and there's, you know, this isn't likely to get changed anytime soon, even if there is more discussion recently about trying to reform Utah's water payment system.
Zach Podmore is a Southern Utah reporter and Report for America core member at the Salt Lake Tribune. And thanks again for making time and explaining this to us. Very clear reporting. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Roger.
Again, Zach's article is at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a break for a couple of minutes. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we'll turn to my conversation with the Tribune's Luke Peterson. Peterson wrote this week about his father's bout with childhood polio and about the warning some childhood polio survivors are issuing about our current epidemic. Peterson is the director of the Salt Lake Tribune's Innovation Lab. And to kick off our conversation, I asked him what the Innovation Lab is and what it aims to do.
Yeah, so the Innovation Lab is a new venture for the Salt Lake Tribune. It is an attempt to not only, I mean, obviously we have a duty as part of the Fourth Estate to keep tabs on things and report the news, whether it's pretty or not, and hold those in power accountable, right? Those are all important functions of what we do. But the Innovation Lab's job is slightly different. It is really more focused on solutions. So we know we got a lot of problems in the world. We got no end of supply of problems, and some that are very particular to Utah. So we're looking, trying to find, you know, what's working, what's going on in the nonprofit sector, what's going on in government, what's going on in the private sector that addresses these challenges. So that's what we do at the Innovation Lab.
Okay, and thanks very much for that explanation. Luke, this week you published a story that looked at the experience of survivors of a past epidemic, polio. And you wrote about childhood polio survivors, among them your father. You know, can we actually define what polio is, first of all? It's an illness caused by a virus, but I think some people, you know, as your story sort of elucidates, might not know what it is. What is polio?
Yeah, so polio is a virus, poliomyelitis virus. It has been around since ancient times. We have accounts from ancient Greece of people suffering from polio. It has a number of symptoms. It often affects large motor functions, the diaphragm, so people develop breathing problems, could affect heart. Probably the most famous polio survivor is FDR, who lost effectively the use of his legs as a result of the disease. And thanks to Salk and the vaccine that was developed in the 1950s, polio, naturally occurring polio, has not naturally occurred in the United States since the 1970s.
Wow. I mean, there is that dividing line, right? When the vaccine is developed, and that's in the 1950s, Jonas yeah. Salk, as you said, very famous example of the development of a vaccine that saved who knows how many lives. In terms of, you know, preventing people from getting polio, it didn't come soon enough for your dad in Payson, Utah. Can you tell us a little bit about his experience with polio?
Yeah. You know, what we know about my dad's experience is not from my dad, who passed away 10 years ago. He hated talking about himself, so it's always hard to get these stories out of him. But I know it mostly from talking with my uncle, his brother, and my dad's cousins, and then a few things that he wrote for class assignments when he was a kid. So he had the virus when he was 4 years old in 1951, and he did not have very severe symptoms at the time. He was hospitalized for several weeks, but no serious long-term consequences. And in fact, that's what he wrote in a class assignment, right? No long-term after effects that he had to deal with. So he was considered one of the lucky ones at the time.
Yeah. I mean, polio, just to remind people, I mean, it used to kill thousands of American kids every summer. It paralyzed many more. And so, right, your dad's symptoms weren't as severe as obviously those. But there are a number of people like your dad who survived, but then, you know, that wasn't the end of their experience with this illness. And in retrospect, you think that your dad had this undiagnosed post-polio syndrome. Can you tell us about post-polio syndrome and what it looks like, basically, Luke?
Yeah. So post-polio syndrome is a condition that really doctors started to talk about, and you see it appearing in medical journals in the 70s into the 80s was when they really began to identify it. It manifests usually with, it's a degenerative condition, and it manifests in the form of weakness, changes to the spine, changes to the heart, fatigue, extreme fatigue, and then a series of odd other symptoms that, for instance, that my dad had, such as extreme sensitivity to cold. I remember Bob Peterson is, that's my dad's name. He had a, what we called Bob's Den, right? It was this little shack behind the house. And that's sort of where he would sit and drink his coffee and smoke his cigarettes and watch TV out there, because he really relied on caffeine and nicotine to sort of stay awake because of the fatigue. But you would go out in winter in the evening, and out of the smokestack, there would be a 4-foot blue flame coming out of there because he could not stand the cold. And he always wore layers, right? He wasn't comfortable unless it was above about 90 degrees outside.
Wow. You know, you said muscle weakness, acute sensitivity to cold, breathing problems, extreme fatigue. There are a lot of people, of course, who polio affected in more pronounced or I guess more visible ways than your dad was, you know, from his actual bout with the virus when he was in hospital. You interviewed someone for the story, Kristen Duffy, and I'm wondering if you can tell us about how polio has impacted her life and specifically how it's still impacting her life.
Yeah, so Kristen was... just an amazing individual to talk with, and she is an amazing individual. She had the virus when she was very young, 2 years old. She had more immediate effects, immediate long-term effects in terms of muscle weakness. She effectively doesn't have a right deltoid. She had to walk with a brace on her leg and then one on her arm for a number of years. And then she too also had post polio, where decades later, her symptoms began to worsen. And then she started to experience them on the other side of her body as well. And muscles would just effectively quit.
Wow. There's a parallel that people dealing with post polio syndrome like Kristen Duffy are seeing now in something that is only slowly coming into better resolution for us because of how close we are to it. And this is COVID-19, you know, long haulers. Well, the sort of warning here is that there's a lot that we just don't know still about the long-term effects of COVID-19. I'm wondering if you can talk about that, Luke. I know you spoke also with a doctor who specializes in physical medicine and long-term illness.
So, yes, the parallels between polio and COVID-19 are several and concerning. And I think the best way to put it is we talk about long haul COVID as if we know what the long haul is with COVID. And it would be more accurate to say that we know what some people have experienced after 18 months. But the experts that I've spoken with, they don't consider long haul COVID to be the equivalent of what will likely be a post COVID syndrome, right? And this is where I scare people, and I don't mean to, but I think it's important just to understand that, you know, to close the loop on the idea that that we know exactly what the consequences of of COVID-19 are. You know, as my dad said when he was a kid, he didn't have any serious after effects. And that was true for about 2 decades. And then he began to develop serious effects that really impaired his daily life, his ability to work, his ability to, you know, do normal dad things, go out and teach his kids how to ride a bike, for example. And so that's the concern, is that as a novel virus that we know has significant impacts, it's likely to have long-term impacts. We just don't know what those look like yet.
And we won't.
And we won't. We won't for a while. Yeah. And the thing that is most striking to me is that, like my dad, generally speaking, polio survivors who are still alive today had it as a kid, right? So they had it when they were young. And so the question that we need to ask ourselves as we're weighing questions about public policy and, you know, should we have masks in schools, is that we don't really know what the long-term consequences may be for young children. My dad, other individuals I spoke to, talk about their initial bout with the virus as being like a bad cold or maybe a bad flu, but then it was over, right? And so the consequences don't come into play until much later.
And it is a little bit, I mean, it is, you said you don't mean to scare people, but it is a little bit scary what we don't know. And I'm wondering, I don't know if you wanted to close that thought. I actually was going to ask you to do something that you may or may not be willing to do, which is I was hoping you could just, you know, the last part of your article is titled "The Dad I Never Knew." And I was wondering if you wouldn't just read those two paragraphs for us. Would that be okay, Luke?
Yeah, that's fine. All right. My dad was a world-class eccentric in ways that go beyond what polio did to him. That was how I knew, admired, and loved him. I don't regret anything about our relationship, but I do mourn the version of my dad I never knew in life. A 6-week illness 70 years ago shaped and limited the experiences I had with my dad and the way I interact with my own children. Now, each morning as I send my kids off to school where few of their fellow students wear masks, I must weigh whether I'm doing the right thing by them and the generation to follow.
I mean, again, it's this sort of roll of the dice, right? Because we don't have the benefit of hindsight of seeing the future, you know, we can't really know what those long-term consequences will be. We're basically just flying in the dark and hoping for the best. Is that the way to put it, Luke?
Yeah, unfortunately it is. And I think that's the reality that we face with this pandemic. And, you know, I think all of us make decisions every day in this pandemic world where we weigh things, right? I weigh the benefits that my child's going to get from being at school and how much they miss their friends and all that sort of thing against the what if. And it's a hard thing. And I have nothing but sympathy for everyone who is out there going through weighing similar choices every day. And I think the other thing that I would say is that the value of just being thoughtful about those decisions, that's what a lot of the polio survivors that I spoke with wanted to communicate. In addition to, I've received so many emails since the story came out where they just say, thank you for not forgetting us. And as a former history professor, I think that there's a window there, right, where we look into the past and we say, what lessons should we learn? And we look into the future and we say, what should I be doing now that I have a deeper understanding of what happened in the last great pandemic?
Luke Peterson is director of the Salt Lake Tribune's Innovation Lab. You can find his article, including some resources for people with post-polio syndrome and for COVID-19 long haulers over at sltrib.com. Luke, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, again, find Luke Peterson's kind of scary but very poignant article on all of this over at sltrib.com. That's all the time we've got for on the show. Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, and join us again next week.